Hello, my name is Paul Scheer, and my favorite thing are the Los Angeles Clippers.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and get recommendations without using an algorithm. To say I'm excited about today's guest is an understatement. You already know because you read the title of the episode. I'm here today with Paul Scheer. Paul is an actor, writer, podcaster, comedian. He is the host of How Did This Get Made and Unspooled. He is the founding producer of Friendzone on Twitch. You know him from TV, from Best Week Ever, The League, Black Monday, Fresh Off the Boat. And in May, his first book is coming out. It is called Joyful Recollections of Trauma. It is available for pre-order now. It ships on May 21st, 2024. Paul, how are you doing?
I am doing great. Leah, it's so amazing to be here with you because I have seen your face many a time from afar. We have been in different cities together. We have, how many How Did This Get Made shows have you seen?
Oh gosh, all but one in Chicago.
Wow.
I've been to Largo 3 or 4 times, I think.
Amazing.
And then Philly and Brooklyn.
You are unbelievable. You definitely are getting some award. I don't know what that award is, but yeah, you would get an award. I would give you an award.
Thank you.
To give you an award.
I have tickets for London, but boy, is that an expensive weekend to be in London.
I know. It's kind of tricky.
Yeah.
Easter weekend is after London. We are in, you could also just make it a Belfast Dublin trip. You can get those.
Yeah.
If you make it out, you know, look, you'll get to see the show wherever you want to see it. I don't want to make you spend all that money for for no reason. I think the show is going to be a lot of fun. But, you know, let me know if you need any tickets. I'll take care of you.
Yeah, I've got some high school girlfriends in London. We all saw Hamilton together 8 or 9 years ago. And so I wanted to introduce them to the podcast. But
it's expensive.
I'm looking at flights every day. That's what I'll say.
All right. Well, I'll tell you this much. It's expensive for me to go to London and I have to do the shows. I've booked the shows there. So I get you.
Yeah.
And I'm traveling with a cabal. I mean, we have my wife, June, and my 2 children. So we're all going to London. So that's 4 plane tickets to London.
Wow.
And whenever we do that, I say to June, aren't you happy that we only have 2 kids and not 3? Because at a time there was a thought, should we have another kid?
Mm-hmm.
And for reasons like this, no, it would be too damn expensive.
Yeah. You just have to draw straws every time.
Yeah. Who can go, who can stay, or who can fit in the luggage. But I'm so excited to do this. And I'm a fan of yours. And I'm excited to be here. And thank you for talking about my book, which apparently this is a very important thing. This pre-order thing is wildly important. I didn't understand that. But I can tell you that if you pre-order the book, what I'm going to do, and I did this at my own expense and probably my own disservice to myself, I am sending everybody a personalized postcard, an autographed personalized postcard to everybody who's pre-ordered. And you will get access to a special site that I built on my website that has a bunch of additional material that you can kind of see, like a little show and tell of the book. But I figured the postcard was really important because I know that I won't be able to get to every place to sign books. And I figured, well, this will be the next best thing. This is not like me just rubber stamping it. This is going to be me, your name, personalization. I'm doing the whole thing. I mean,
That'll
talk to me
fun.
Once I get 2,000 cards in, I'll be dead.
So let's start with the book. I talk to a lot of authors on the podcast and I'm curious. I mean, I think I know
mm-hmm.
that the book came bubbled up in part from stories that pop up on the podcast. Occasionally you'll drop these little stories from your childhood and people have said, put it in a book. So I imagine that was part of the catalyst, but where did the book come from for you?
No, you're totally right. I started telling these stories on How Did This Get Made? We've been doing this show for 14 years or 13 and a half years. And when I started telling these stories about my childhood, it didn't really occur to me how bizarre they were because, you know, they were just the stories of my life and they were stories that I would tell or that we would talk about in our family, but we're not critiquing those. And when I told it on stage and to Jason and June's often horrified expressions, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, huh, maybe it wasn't so normal. You know, and you're right. People were saying, oh, write a book. But I felt like everybody writes a book. I felt like there's so much book writing out there that mm-hmm. I didn't want to just like add to that pile. I knew that there was going to be a difference between a bunch of funny anecdotes versus a book. And I took that really seriously. So I started to write a little while ago, and knowing that the stories I tell are just one part of the story, there's a lot more there. And if I wanted to go there, I'd have to go a lot deeper and tell the full story. So that's really what I did. And I started writing. And once I felt like I had about 60 or 70 pages, I found an agent and I got some notes from them. And then we went out and pitched it. And then once I sold the book continually changed every draft. Like I just handed it in a few weeks ago, the final copy edited version. And every time I got it, every time I looked at it, something changed about it. And it was like a continual crafting of this book. And I'm really happy with it. I think if you're a How Did This Get Made fan, you will get the stories that you want, I think. Mm-hmm. But I think you're going to get something unexpected in there as well. I also, sadly, felt like I need to write another book because I barely scratched the surface. I feel like, oh my gosh. But this book is like very thematic. It's not like the story of my life. It is a story about really a part of my life, really, mm-hmm. which is like kind of from being parented to becoming a parent, really, would be like the story that kind of tracks in there.
Nice. Are you planning any launch events yet? Or right now you're focused on pre-order, making that happen?
No, we're going to do it up. We're going to be in DC. We're going to be in New York and Chicago. Oh, yeah, we're going to be in Chicago doing a big show there. Yeah. So there's going to be a lot of events coming up. I have a big, giant plan that I can't reveal just yet. But if I'm able to pull it off, I'll be very, very excited. But yeah, I'm trying to make it. Look, I understand that buying a book, buying anything, asking anyone for money in this economy, in this moment right now, I take that very seriously. Whether it's doing our shows live or, you know, to me, I am a fan. I'm a fanboy. I love the things that I love. And that's mm-hmm. why I'm excited to be on the show today. But more importantly, I love when the people that I love put attention and energy into what they're doing. And I think the book is worth its price, obviously, but I also appreciate that people are supporting me, and already seeing the amount of books that I've sold has been amazing. And I'm so overwhelmed that I want to make sure that I'm just saying thank you. And if you can't make it out to a book signing, if you can't make it out to an event, you'll be taken care of. And it just was important to me. And that's why I wanted to build this website, because I'm a big fan of like DVD special features. So I figured mm-hmm. I'd make book special features.
Nice. I'm curious, how did, you know, your IMDb is so long.
Oh, yeah.
Which is great, including writer's credits. So I'm curious, how was writing a book for you versus writing scripts, writing sketches, movies, screenplays? Like, how was the experience of sitting down to write a book versus those other types of writing projects you are involved in?
It was, in some ways, the most liberating thing and solitary thing that I've ever done. I think in writing a book, and you know, because you write too, right? Like the idea that you are, it's locked in amber. When I write scripts, you know, I know that, all right, this is the script that's going to get hopefully approved. And then once mm-hmm. that gets approved, then I'm going to cast it and it's going to change a little bit. And then when we do rewrites, it's a constant evolution. You get into the edit room. The script is, it's like, the script is a blueprint. Book, there's no blueprint. Now, I'd written a handful of Marvel comics as well, and those were equally like, it's locked, you have to do mm-hmm. it, but it's shorter, it's smaller, you could do that. And for me, as somebody who is an improviser and a comedian, it's like, I always want to get back in there. For years, I'm making fun of George Lucas for, you know, messing around with Star Wars. But I realize, oh, I'm of that same ilk. I'm like, oh, I see something I want to fix. Oh, I got that now. And sometimes space can give you that. So I feel like this book has only been read at this point by one person. Oh, actually two. My assistant, the amazing Molly, who I feel like, for those of you who don't know, Molly's a producer on How Did This Get Made. She's my assistant. She is a co-collaborator in so many projects I do. She's just amazing. And Molly read my stuff for the first time as I was writing it kind of in secret, and really gave me inspiration to keep on going. And so she's read it, and June has read it. And those are the only two people. And now, as I get into this next phase where there's a completed manuscript and things, now more people will read it. Mm-hmm. But I really wrote it in isolation, and there's something really freeing about it. And it was exhausting, and it was, I don't know, I loved it. And it actually made me want to write more. That's why I started the Substack too, mm-hmm. and trying to get involved. Like, it's like, oh, I miss writing. And even if it's just like small little things, it just keeps me in the habit of doing it. Because sometimes I feel like I binge write. You know, it's like, oh, I, you know, if I'm running a show, you're yeah. writing so much, you're editing so much, you're answering so many questions that all of a sudden it's over. And you're like, I don't have to do anything. I'm so psyched. And then you forget about it. But if you keep that motor kind of running, it's good. It's like, it's, so I'm hoping to keep that motor running and continue to write a little bit. I feel inspired to do it, but man, oh man, it was intense.
Yeah. I hear you on that. When I was blogging, you know, for like almost a decade, I blogged every day. And when I was doing that, then it was really easy to write short stories or yeah. work on bigger projects. Cause like the pump was primed,
right? Great.
Do morning pages, do a blog, write for work, right over here. And then I don't know if it was like starting to commute in a car so I don't have space out time mm-hmm. or Twitter, because I've been on Twitter forever too. You know, like a lot of excuses for like getting out of the habit of writing.
Well, we've become like so accustomed to this, like we're in a culture of short burst writing, right? Mm-hmm. It's like an Instagram post, a Twitter, you know, Twitter kind of conditioned us. I mean, I started on Blogger, then went to Tumblr, yep. you know, and Tumblr was smaller than Blogger, although you could make Tumblrs longer, but, you know, it wasn't the intent. And everything just got shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And our attention spans are shorter. And our, you know, it's like, it's so funny. I send out mailers about how did this get made, you know, to tell people, oh, we have a show coming up. We're doing this. And there is like an analytical, like an AI reader in that mail program. And basically they give you like tips on how to mm-hmm. make sure it's the most effectively read. And it's the less words you can put for everything. It's like image, link, done. Yeah. That is it. And it's like, oh, wow, we forget like the stuff that we love, all the things that we are committed to were made with a lot more care and technique than what we are forced, what's in front of our face at all times. So I think mm-hmm. it's like wrestling with that and understanding like, I don't know, like that our place in this world where we are kind of not told to read books anymore. Or I mean, I know people read books, but it's like I didn't have an iPad growing up. I read so many books. Yeah. I read so many books in New York City when I was on the subway. You talk about that extra time. Like, and you get caught up in this culture where it's like, oh, I'm reading a headline. I think I understand that. I mm-hmm. referenced something today that I didn't even read the full story on, but I was like, oh, like so-and-so. I'm like, oh, oof, I don't want to be that person, you know, and we all are. And it's like not even, well, not we all are. I am.
You're not alone in yes. that. Yeah. Yeah. A friend called me this weekend to ask my opinion about using a Daniel Burnham quote in a speech. And mm-hmm. Daniel Burnham was one of the city planners of Chicago.
Right.
And he was like, do you know how this quote ends? And I'm like, I'm sure that when we were all reading Devil in the White City, like when everybody in the L yes. was reading that book, I knew what the quote was. I was like, not anymore.
Yeah. It's funny that like that thing where you just like parts of your brain shut off like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a joke that I wanted to do in my book that I didn't get a chance to do where I didn't figure out exactly how I wanted to do it. But, you know, I wanted to put a quote in the front of my book because I feel like everybody has these quotes. And I'm like, where are you getting these quotes? Like, mm-hmm. is this important to you? Or did you just like find a quote? You know, did you type in like hard life quote? And here it is, you know? And, you know, I was toying around with like, here is a very, like, it was like, this quote is here because I want to make my book seem more important. And it was me quoting myself saying that, you know, mm-hmm. so I just was like, you know, I was just trying to figure
out. You should have quoted the Blues Travelers,
their
song about writing a good pop song.
Ooh, what is that?
The hook brings you back. All the lyrics of the song describe how to write a pop song.
Oh my gosh. I remember that song.
Yeah.
That's great. All right. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll put it in. Maybe I can sneak it in there.
Yeah. It's a great, it was their biggest hit. And it was just about, once you really listen to it, it was just about writing a pop song.
Well, it's funny because I did a Weird Al Yankovic podcast one time and mm-hmm. we picked this George Harrison song and it was like the song of Weird Al is This song is just 3 words long. This song is just 3 words long. And it's a deconstruction of like pop music. And it's so great. I love that kind of stuff. And again, you're right. Like, this is the time where everyone's singing it. They don't even know what they're singing, but they're just like, no one's like going, oh, that's such a satirical song. That's why I'm singing it. Like, you're hooked on it. Weezer does that all the time, where they used to.
No, there were a lot of, I think college was when I found out that I only knew the Weird Al version of a lot of songs.
Oh, I know. I probably know the Weird Al version of most songs better than the real songs. Absolutely.
Yeah. But I think that one in particular, I was aware enough of pop music that like I had heard the George Harrison song before the Weird Al song came out. And that was like one of the only times that it ever happened.
I think that song, it's so funny because George Harrison is singing a song that's also like deconstructing like modern relationships, because like it's like he wants to get a girl, but it's gonna take money for him to get this girl. Right. Like, you know, it's like it's not like about
a whole
love.
Lot of spending money.
Yeah,
right?
A whole lot of money. It's like, yep. It's like it's funny to have a parody song about a song parodying the modern like relationship problems.
Well, Paul, your book is ostensibly what brought us here today.
I appreciate it. Thank you for letting me be here with you.
Yeah, the timing is great. But we're also here to talk about one of your favorite things.
Yes, and I thought about this long and hard because I'm a fan of so many things. Unfortunately, and actually, you know, it's funny that you mentioned this is what I talk about in my book. I can't put this stuff up in my house anymore. Mm-hmm. I have an office. A lot of these things that I love live in my office. And, you know, whether that is like a sideshow collectible of Old Dirty Bastard coming out of like the subway in Brooklyn, or like, and I have an obsession with like toys that are somehow completely destroyed. Like there's an image of Iron Man from Spider-Man, the third one, No Way Home, the one with Mysterio, or maybe that's the second one. Okay. Where like Peter Parker sees like Iron Man, like a zombie Iron Man rising from the grave. I have that right next to in my Doctor Strange, who's also possessed by like the devil. Like I have these ugly superheroes. And then I also have tons of Funko Pops of weird things like the Mandalorian or Baby Grogu. Or maybe it's not Baby, just Grogu. Like as a Macy's Day Parade float, I have like characters from Leftovers, Odd Job from Goldfinger, of course, Axel Foley. I have stuff that I've brought with me my entire life. I also have like a giant collection of Clippers bobbleheads. Now, I am a big Los Angeles Clippers fan. And I thought that I would talk about that because what's so interesting about that is, you know, I think that people sometimes get turned off with sports. I think it's very easy to be like, I'm not a sports person. Yeah. And I feel like what I wanted to do in coming on here today is not try to convert you to be a sports person, but talk about the inherent drama and story that is going on when you like a team. So I grew up a New York Knicks fan. I grew up in New York. I moved out to LA and I had a decision to make. I could continue to be a Knicks fan, which was a real knife in the gut endeavor. Like it just is hard to do. They got close and then they always kind of fell apart.
Yeah, we're close in age. And so my graduation... spring convocation 1995, my dad sat in the front row. It was Pacers Knicks, like game five.
Wow.
And he like told me like, okay, I'll say like they're up 2 points, they're down. And eventually everybody in my class that was on stage realized my dad was listening to Pacers Knicks. And they were all just watching him listening on like a little earbud.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, a lot of heartbreak in those Knicks years. And so I came out to LA and I was like, I need to pick a different team. And I immediately knew that the Lakers felt like a bandwagon choice. Like everyone's a Laker fan. Mm-hmm. What could I do? What could be more fun? And so the Clippers at this point were kind of becoming interesting. You had Blake Griffin on the team. They were making some changes. And it felt like it would be fun. Also, tickets were very affordable, like comically so.
I have a question about, were the Clippers an expansion team? Were they, no. Did they move from another city? I feel like...
Well, the story about the Clippers is kind of interesting, right? Because, I mean, there were no basketball teams in LA originally. I mean, because the Lakers are the Great Lakes.
They're Minnesota.
Yep. Yeah. So, or Michigan, right? They're Michigan, I think. Maybe it's Minnesota. Whatever. One of those places.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not a Laker historian. But the Clippers were originally the Buffalo Braves, and they were up in Buffalo.
Oh, okay.
And the owner was obsessed with getting them out of Buffalo. So very much Fair. Like, like very much like a Major League, the movie, plotting. Like they figured if we lost enough games, we can then, and the attendance goes low enough, we can then move the team.
Move, okay.
So at this point, the Lakers have moved to Los Angeles, and this owner at the time buys them and moves them to San Diego. So they were the San Diego Clippers. The Buffalo Braves switched to become the San Diego Clippers, and the Clippers are clipper ships that would be out in the San Diego ocean or harbor or whatever they have there. So that was going well. And then the owner's like, well, this is San Diego. That's not as fun as LA. Mm-hmm. And then moves to LA and plays like the way the Clippers came to LA is sus. I mean, 100%. Like, it's just, you know, it was just following the leader going like, oh, I want that same thing too. I want that.
Yeah.
I don't want to be in San Diego. I want to be here. And so they moved to LA. They kind of forced their way in. So I understand that people who remember it and were around are like, get out of here. You're not an LA team. They feel, you know, it feels inorganic, right? But, and especially when you have a team like you have the Lakers or these championships, like it feels like you're kind of moving in or something like that.
Yeah.
So for me, I came in way after all that. I don't come in with any sort of baggage. I come in going, I want to see basketball. I like basketball. I hope to have a family one day. And if I do, I want my kids to see games they can go to.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not the biggest sports guy. I mean, it's funny because I've been on a show about fantasy football and I talk about the Clippers a lot, but I'm not like I need to be in front of my TV all the time, but I do like them. And I also know like how much that was a bonding experience to have with my dad going to games with him. So I really wanted to have that with my kids eventually. So I started going to Clippers games. And why I love the Clippers is because I came in when they were an underdog. And I think a lot of comedians I know are Clippers fans. And I think it's like, there is something fun about just the fight against a bigger entity, right? There's no fun about being Goliath. We like David, you know, we like David. And I feel like that's what was great about it. Like they had something to prove. They had a chip on their shoulder. They wanted something. And I think on some level, they just seem more fun. I always say like, the Lakers are a Hollywood team, and Hollywood is full of glitz and glamour and like awards and the Clippers. And I know many LA people will disagree with what I'm about to say. And the Clippers are more of a Los Angeles team. They are the working class of Los Angeles. They are the people that are just moving about their day. They're not in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. They're just doing it. And that's what I really like. And when you got Blake Griffin on the team, that really sold the deal because Blake Griffin is funny. And I remember when the NBA went on strike, he became an intern at Funny or Die, and that sealed the deal. Once he became an intern at Funny or Die, I was like, I am now a Clippers fan. Blake is funny. And Blake was like in the slam dunk competition, doing all this stuff that made you just be like, I'm all on board. I like this team. I like this guy. And I started to get a little bit more involved with them. Like my friend did a live read of Space Jam, and he got Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan to like read the characters it was so much fun. DeAndre played Charles Barkley and Blake played Michael Jordan. So all of a sudden, I'm like, I want to have an LA team. I can go get some seats to this. I remember when we started off the first season of NTSF, I bought everybody in the cast and all the writers tickets to a game. We all went to a game. It was really fun. I felt like a big shot because I could afford a bunch of tickets.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
From time to time, I'll do a group buy of like Blackhawks tickets, and it's just a blast. It's
right,
a blast.
It's a blast
to go live sports with a group is a ton of fun.
It is
a ton of fun.
Yes. So now all of a sudden, this casual fandom starts to build. And I start to watch. And look, they're heartbreaking, too. There's highs and lows. And then we lose Blake. And what I started to find in 2018, 2019, I think this like really locked in my Clipper fandom. There are these two guys that I love so much, Pat Beverly and Lou Williams. They led this team that had no superstars on it. Basically, the Clippers were getting ready to sign somebody big. That person would eventually become Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. but they needed to like get rid of all their salary so they could afford a big salary.
Yep.
So this season, the 2018-2019 season, no one expected anything of these Clippers. And these guys were a lot of players who've been on other teams, have been around, that no one expected, like role players, like the character actors of our, you know, of our, of the basketball
so
world.
So they're league veterans, low expectations. Their day is done, but they're still in the league.
Yes. And they'll never be the all-star, but they got time left. Yeah. They've and man, oh man, they played this season. They played their hearts out. And every game was so much fun because even if they lost, it was like something was going on. And this is a really triumphant season because they came back from a 34-point deficit in San Francisco to beat Golden State to extend a playoff series. Like things are getting exciting. Yeah. And that to me is like, that's what I love about sports. I'm not looking at it and going like, oh, they're running this kind of a play or that. I am watching the stories kind of play out. And the NBA to me is a place where you have the best stories because it's one of the few places where the athletes are allowed to be themselves. Like they get to, you get to see them. That's why there's so many podcasts in the NBA. Like you go like, oh my gosh. And you get to hear them, whether it's like, you know, Karl Anthony Towns, like lost his mom during COVID. It became a thing. It was like, not to minimize loss, but it became like, we're there with him. Like, you know, and like that team that I loved, the 2018-2019 Clippers, they like Lou Williams got the Sixth Man of the Year award that year. And it was like, oh my God, like this guy, like on a team where no one expected anything of this guy, he wins this major NBA award. And I feel like that's the kind of stuff that gets very soap opery, very like, I mean, it's very much like a Bravo thing where you're like, but you know, it doesn't come right away. You have to kind of commit. And I feel like in the past when I got into sports, I'm like, I like all of the NFL. Like I'm like Rob Lowe wearing that hat just says NFL at an NFL game. Like, no, you have to find a team and get into the nitty gritty. And it's not about wins and losses because like, no matter what, you're going to be with them. It's not about like, it's like, it's, you know, you're just, you're adopting a dog. Like, you know, on some level, it's like, yeah, that through thick or thin, you're going to be there. And it's like, and I know you're from Chicago, like, or you're in Chicago right now. It's like, that's such a sports hub. Like that's such a, you know, people are live and die by these teams. And I think what it is, and maybe this is a bold thing to say, but for people, let's just say this. If I'm going to be very stereotypical, I'll say, all right, well, a majority of men are into sports. It seems like that's like, it feels like sometimes the energy is like men do sports. That's what we like. And I think that the reason maybe for that on some level is because it allows them to experience different types of emotions. Like the same way that like I might watch, you know, a great movie or even a Bravo show. Like Bravo, I think is so fascinating because it captures, I think, such a wide swath of people and women and relationships. And I think that that's why Andy Cohen's a genius and why every woman I know loves Bravo. And a lot of men too, myself included. But it allows you to kind of have these emotions. I remember the first time I showed my kids E.T., they were crying. And I was like, oh, this like affected them. Like it got through. And I was like, I want to make my kids cry more. Like, I feel like I've watched so many stupid Paw Patrols and all this other stuff that has no like emotional core. And I just realized that like, that's such an important part of our life to have ups and downs and emotions and you know, tremendous excitement. Like last night, I went to a Clippers game and they were down the entire game. And in the fourth quarter, they came back. It was like a 41-15 quarter, right? So they had a 22-0 run in the end of the fourth. And I went from being like, oh, this is a bummer. My kids are here. This is not fun. To like leaving. And I was on a high all last night. And it's not like I could do that or I want to do that. But it's like, it's giving you these emotional, just these emotional ways to connect. And I feel like the way that people kind of talk about sports sometimes is, well, you got to know this person has the highest scoring record or this or that or this or that. I think you got to go real micro and you have to go like, what's going on here is these guys used to be former teammates and they didn't like each other. Now watch out for this, like, or this, like, and get in slow and get in easy, learn about the team, find the team, like what, embrace it. It becomes a cast of characters. And when they leave, it's sad. It is everything that I love about TV. It's like there's drama, there's stories. Will they make it? Will they won't? You know, will someone get injured? What happens when some people get injured? Like, read into the press conferences, it becomes something. It's like, I'm not here looking at a betting line and going like, guys, get into betting. But it's like, it's about like, I think finding the humanity in these teams and seeing how that really can make you a better person in a way.
Yeah. There was a moment when I was like obsessed with Hamilton, and it was in Chicago for like 3 years.
Let me ask you a question. How many Hamiltons did you see? Like not of Chicago, but because I want to talk to you about this as well. Like I saw Hamilton in LA. I saw Hamilton in New York, and I saw Hamilton on Disney Plus. How many different people did you see come through Hamilton?
I saw the original Broadway cast.
Okay.
Everyone but David Diggs was in the night I saw it. And then I saw, went like a couple months later and saw like the next cast. New York. So Broadway, Chicago, I think I saw it like 7 times.
Okay. Amazing.
So a lot of, and then I saw it on the West End in London.
Whoa. Okay. Let me ask you a question about, and this is probably too inside baseball.
No, ask away.
All right. Watching Hamilton for the first time on Broadway with no pomp and circumstance. It was before the Tonys got announced. I just happened to go see it. I worked it into a contract. I was getting paid very poorly for a show. And I said, if you get me tickets to Hamilton, I will do this. And they said, really? And I was like, yeah. And they got me tickets.
Nice. Well done.
Yeah. So Rob Hubel and I saw it. Rob didn't even know what it was. So he said, I feel like I saw it just knowing like, oh, I heard the show is good. Mm-hmm. That's how I, you know. I love the New York version. I was blown away by it. I was like, oh my God, everyone needs to see this New York version. Now I will say, when I saw it in LA, I thought the casting was even better. Like, I feel like I saw the show differently. Did you feel like you saw the show differently with different casts? Like, that you were like, oh, it almost like the show took on a different thing in a way. Mm-hmm.
So I think I am very grateful to myself for buying myself a ticket to see the original cast, right?
Yeah.
Like that was
peak
single business lady thing to do, like fly out for a Wednesday night Hamilton. I was always really bummed I didn't get to see Javier, who co-created Hamilton with Lin.
Yes.
Because I think, and I hope someday my paths cross with Lin-Manuel. I adore him. He's the weakest Hamilton.
There you go. You know, I mean, like this is...
Miguel, who was in Chicago and who just retired from the role after like 2,000 shows on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Over the course of Hamilton in Chicago, his daughter, who was born with epilepsy, passed away.
Oh, wow.
And watching Miguel go from being a father who had never lost a child to a father who had lost a child over the course of his career as Hamilton changed the show completely.
Wow. I can only imagine that. Whoa.
Like, I have goosebumps thinking about how it was to go see him perform after Adelaide had passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just saw the most recent cast, and they are having so much fun. They are making it their own. They are no longer trying to, of course, the choreography is the same, right?
Right.
But they are no longer trying to replicate Broadway. These casts, like the cast you saw in LA, they're having fun. They're owning the characters. They're diving in, and they are making it their own. And I think it is still such a fun show, such a moving show. And yeah, but absolutely, the different casts are all different.
It really is amazing. I saw, and I'm probably going to mispronounce his name because that is something that I do. That is my unfortunate Achilles heel. But Michael Luowi do it, and he played Hamilton. And it was just, I think what I realized about Hamilton that I didn't get from Lin. And what I think is interesting about this is like, Lin is Hamilton. Like, that is my Hamilton, 100%.
Yep.
But I also believe that the writing is so strong that when you put a very strong, for lack of a better term, alpha male in the Hamilton role, it actually works way better, because that's, like, I think we see Hamilton as being scrappy with Lin. Like, he's scrappy. Mm-hmm. He got up. And there's something about somebody, like, in that time, they would have had to have been not scrappy. Like, they had, like, you know, they'd have to be stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be just fascinating to watch the same show and not go, one performance is better than the other, but go, oh, I I felt like I got Hamilton when I mm-hmm. saw it in a different way.
Yeah. And over time, sometimes I go to see it and I'm like, oh, I'm a Hamilton, you know, I'm going to do everything I can. And then sometimes I'm like, no, I'm in a Burr phase. I'm just like,
oh, yeah,
I'm just going to not publicly do anything. I'm just going to like be cool. I'm going to like keep my opinions to myself. And it's also, I mean, because I've been listening to it and watching it now for 8 years, it's really been some ebbs and flows of who I connect with in the story.
Well, you know, it's so funny. I just did a movie with Anthony Ramos. I worked for a day mm-hmm. with Anthony Ramos, who was in the original Broadway cast. And I was so, like, I was so psyched to see him. You know, I've talked to David Diggs, saw him as well. Like, I've seen so many things on Broadway. I grew mm-hmm. up in New York, you know, so when I was a kid, seeing Broadway was not financially out of reach. Like, right. It was like you could go see, I feel like, and maybe people are like, you're insane. But when I was a kid, I feel like we're going to see like Neil Simon plays for like $25 or $35. Like
you were
seeing like, yeah, right. And it's like, it wasn't a big deal. It was like, we just see a ton. And to this day, Hamilton as a show affected me probably the most of anything I've ever seen on stage. And I would say then a close second is Book of Mormon. But Book of Mormon was different because Book of Mormon, I was like, oh, whoa, this is what you can do. And it was so interesting. And I really like went away going like, oh, well, Rannells and Gad are so great. And there were so right. many great performances. But like that one I saw again, and it didn't hold up for me as much. I have this feeling about certain things where I'm like, I refuse to see things again. Like I loved Dumb and Dumber the first time I saw it, the movie mm-hmm. Dumb and Dumber. I refuse to ever watch it again because I laughed so hard. And I was so excited to take June to go see Book of Mormon. And maybe it was the company that we saw, who knows? Mm-hmm. It just didn't hold the same water the second time. It felt a little, I don't know, just felt less. And maybe that's what we're talking about. Like this idea, like there's a thing with Broadway that people don't know that when you go on a tour, they are told to mimic the actors that are on the Broadway stage, right? Mm-hmm. On some level, right? So they're not necessarily even doing like their interpretation of the character. They're doing an interpretation of the actor who originated the role.
Yep.
And that's hard. It's hard. And sometimes, you know, it's like you lose a little piece of personality. But with Hamilton, I felt like that never really happened. I feel like everyone kind of stepped into their own role. But that's maybe because the writing is better. I don't know.
I think it's such strong writing and choreography and set design that within those constrictions, people can have, there's room for a lot of creativity.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that's, you know, it's such an important thing. Sorry, I don't know how we got off on this whole Hamilton sidetrack, but yeah.
Oh, I remember.
All right.
Is that getting into Hamilton for me was one, the thing that I was like, you know what? Fuck this Gen X thing. We're like, we're too cool for everything. It's actually fun to love something.
Yes.
And then I started following like, oh, who was leaving Broadway and who was going to be in the pro shot and who was going cast here? And I was like, oh, this is sports. This
right,
is
okay.
following football players. This is following athletes around the league is what I'm doing with following Hamilton casts. And it unlocked
yes.
for me understanding sports fandom.
Well, because I think what is interesting about sports, and again, it's like that it gets a bad rap, but it's like we're looking at it the wrong way. And I think if you can like sit with somebody and create the small stakes that are happening, like, mm-hmm. for example, if you look at, I know Taylor Swift has brought so much to the NFL this year. You know, obviously so many people have watched it. And how did they get in? Well, they got in because they love Taylor Swift.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, well, who does Taylor like? Oh, she likes Travis Kelce. Okay, now I'm in on these two people. So I guess I like the Chiefs. Well, if I like the Chiefs, I'm also going to kind of look at Patrick Mahomes, but also mm-hmm. I'm going to go now and find out about Jason Kelce because I'm going to watch that documentary that's over here. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, I like Jason, Travis Kelce. I like the Chiefs. I like Patrick Mahomes. Now you're like, okay. Like it, and it just starts to build out because it's like,
yeah,
it's not like, oh, I like that play. I like that they win. I mean, maybe for some people it is, but it is this, can they handle it? What can they do?
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember when the Clippers were in the bubble and they had their implosion in the bubble. I talked to Paul George at one point. I was very lucky to talk to him and telling me about the anxiety he was having there. And it was like, Eric was saying he's washed up. He can't do anything. He's come back and proven himself multiple times now as being a playoff worthy person. But they're like, playoff
yeah.
P, he's got nothing. He's got nothing. And it's like, and you watch these like people come back from being ridiculed. Because that's the other thing too, with sports is like, We may discard you in movies. We may discard you as whatever. But man, in sports, they hang you out to dry. They want to cut off your head and let everyone look at you and be like, you suck. You wrecked it. You're the worst. And that's Shakespearean almost in the way that they lift people up and destroy them.
Paul, I'm curious about the game experience for you and your family. Mm-hmm. Do you have key foods you like at the stadium? Do you like to get there early for all the pre-show? Do you want to be there for like all the games and stuff? Or are you there like at tip-off?
Here's how I do it. If I have my druthers, I have my whole plan out. First of all, I am not a fan of human beings wearing basketball jerseys out in public. I feel like it's a hard look to pull off, but I have made an exception. When I go to Clippers games, I will wear a basketball jersey. I will normally put it under something or, oh, you know, I'm not just showing my armpits either. So that's one thing. I always am in a costume when I'm going to a game, and it could be subtle. It could just be a jacket. I bought two vintage jackets on eBay. It could be, you know, it could be a hat, but I am repping on some level. Okay. Got that. I do like to get there for the Clippers games. And I think a lot of these stadiums have like fireworks and stuff like that for when they come out of the, I like that. I don't need to get there earlier than that. But my secret trick is when I get into the stadium, I'll have access to start ordering remotely from the vendors. So I go in, I get my seat, then I get my buzz. Hey, it's ready. Then so I don't miss game time for it, you know, and.
Smart.
And with kids now, they love the halftime entertainment. So I used to get up and walk around and see what's up. No, my kids are like, we want to see the dog on a balancing beam. We want to see the kids play basketball. So that is my thing. As far as leaving early, I don't often do it. I will sometimes do it in the case of two things. If the game is just bumming me out, I'll leave early. And you know, it's like if there's no chance of a turnaround, and I'm talking about, you know, 5 minutes left in the fourth quarter. Like it's like, and we're down by, you know, too much. It's like, you know, so I can tell my kids, when my kids want to leave, I will leave early, except if it's a playoff game, then they have to fall asleep on me. I'm sorry. They asked to come. That's what they, I'm not leaving early for a playoff game. And I'm not a funny watcher of the game. Like I sit near funny watchers who like will shout out really clever things, and mine are always too complicated. When I try to get it. So I just stick with the boos and the yays and, you know, and I like to jump up out of my seat a lot. I will say that the best, like not catcall, but like the best yelling, like taunting I've ever heard. Now I'm up in this section. I have my season tickets there. I'm looking down. We're playing a team where there's a player called Christian Wood, deadly silent in the arena. Like, it's just like, it's a low key game, like a Tuesday game or something like that. And all I hear is Wood. No one likes you. You have no friends. And I thought that was the funniest thing. You have no friends. Like, it was like, what a way to like call, no, you have no friends. No one likes you. And it made me laugh so hard. I only wish to be able to throw something like that out there. I get too complicated.
Will you travel for Clippers games, or if Clippers games are happening when you're traveling, will you go to them?
Yes and yes. So I have traveled to Phoenix for a playoff game, and there I try to be respectful as a opposing fan. I understand that I'm surrounded by fans of their team. I don't want to be that annoying person because I hate it when I'm around that. So I keep my jersey tucked away till the tip off, throw it on. The game is over. Take off that jersey, walk out. I figured I was going to avoid any big conflicts. So I do that. But my son and I have been going to games. Our new rule with each other is we'll pick an NBA game and we'll go anywhere that NBA game is. And we love doing that. So we just go off as a little treat to ourselves. And what I like to do there is not go when the Clippers play, because then we like to root for the team. So last year we went to go see Golden State. And we rooted for Golden State. It was great. I don't want to be, it actually makes going to an opposing stadium more fun It's like, all right, tonight we'll be Hawks fans. Tonight we're going to be Sacramento Kings fans. And it, then you actually get to experience the culture of the place. I went to Oklahoma Thunder game a little while ago. I was like, that's the way to do it. You got to experience the culture. You can't be, you know, an enemy in plain sight.
Nice. I will tell you the thing that I grew up in Indiana. So what I always loved about, you know, so like Larry Bird played basketball in my hometown, college ball in my hometown. And what I always loved about basketball is it's also one of the only sports where things actually can change until the buzzer goes off at the end.
Yes.
It is one of the most dramatic, I think, sports available because it can really keep changing all the way to the end. And that's always what I loved about basketball.
The Clippers were down 18 points. And then this fourth quarter, it started to turn around. They outscored the team 41-15 and had a 22-0 run at the end. And I was already committed. Like, we were actually talking about going home. That was one of those games where, like, we had a bunch of kids with us yesterday. It was like a big kid day because it was a noon game. And we're like, let's go home. I mean, you know, I was like, it was just a bummer. But when it turns, oh my gosh, wow. And that was, I mean, like I said, I was like on cloud nine.
So is there anything about the Clippers being a fan of basketball that I haven't asked you about that you'd be sad to leave without saying?
Yes. Thank you. So here's the thing. I talked about the underdogs, right? And I talked about having, like, picking a team like that. Now, the Clippers are one of the handful of NBA teams that has never won a championship. Wow. So that is really interesting, right? Like, that's like they have no banners to hang. They have no trophies. They are a team that was owned by this incredible racist, think like Donald Trump, but a slumlord, but that's kind of what Donald Trump did too. So the same. It's like a West Coast version of
West Coast Trump with maybe more actual money.
Yes. Oh, 1,000,000%.
Had money.
No,
a
successful Donald Trump. Yes. Yeah, yeah, I would agree. And he nickeled and dimed this team so much for so long and did so many things that were so racist and so weird. But like he was having the coaches reuse bandages on, like, after you wrap an arm or something like that, they reuse. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, there's a book called The Curse, which really details all of this stuff. And it's about the curse of the Clippers. And, you know, they were supposed to get Larry Bird. You talk about Larry Bird. They were supposed to get him. Yep. But this owner decided, no, I don't think he's going to be that good. So he opted to get two other people in front of Larry Bird. Right. So it was like that kind of, they made all these mistakes. So there's something really fun about supporting a team that has never really made it. So I know when I talk about the underdogs, so you go in the highs and the lows. And the way I always say it is, like, when they've had a bad, I don't even say bad season, because every season is like, sometimes it's disappointing. Mm-hmm. You know, I never think I'm going to throw in the towel as a fan. You know, I'm upset that we lost. I'm upset that we didn't fulfill a potential, whatever. But I'm not ever going to walk away. It's like my children. They can make me angry. They can make me upset, but I will never walk away from them. But the thing that's so interesting about them is they do have this, like, larger thing on top of them. They've never won anything. So when people go, aren't mm-hmm. you upset that they didn't do it this year? I'm like, I'm not, because they haven't done it any year. It's not like they're letting me down. This is what they have done. This is the team. Yeah. And if this is the year, great. And if it's not, great. It's like there's only up in being a Clippers fan, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that, to me, that's why I think you have Lakers fans right now this season in particular freaking out. You know, like, and I think, like, you know, it's, I think Chicago's really interesting too, because the Bulls are a franchise that, yes, you had your Michael Jordan years, amazing. But it is a team that's like, you get, like, you understand what to expect as a Bulls fan. Oh, we think we can do it. Oh, we think this is going to work out. Oh, we think, okay, oh, no, it doesn't. Oh, and you have had Pat Bev there too. Like, you, like, it's just, there's a fulfilling feeling of not having much at stake. You know, it's like, I want it to be good, but like, I don't have to, like, worry about, like, where I think Lakers fans freak out is like, fire everybody, get rid of them, do this, do that. And it's like, no. It's like, it's a process. It's a growth. It teaches you patience. Again, as the emotional core of all of us. And I do think that if we can do that, and by the way, if you go like, Paul, you've not convinced me. I don't like sports. I don't like basketball. I will never watch a game. Then all I'll say is this. If that is all true, watch three random 30 for 30s and then tell me you don't like sports. Because 30 for 30s are the ESPN documentary series that essentially is doing exactly what I'm saying. They're just saying, hey, this is the interesting story here going on. behind the scenes that you never got to see. The game is a secondary story to that. It's all about everything else. And that's what I'll say. So as somebody who is not like grown up in a household where we love sports, watch sports, I found it to be an incredible bonding experience. I find it to be, you know, just something fun and alive. And it's like, oh, I can go watch a game and I don't know the outcome of it. I can't get ahead of it. You know, I love it. Yep. So it's like, it gives you a lot to do. That's what I would say.
Yeah. We grew up watching, we were a Bears house because my dad thought the way that the Colts left Baltimore was sleazy.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Yep. So we were a Bears house and Pacers. And yeah, absolutely. Growing up watching sports was a huge deal.
I love it. And the Pacers is a fun team to be. I mean, Bears and Pacers. Fun. I mean, you also had the fun Bears too. Yeah, right? Like, I mean, or is that? Yep.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah, it was good. Paul, where can people find you on the internet?
I am at Paul Scheer everywhere that you want to get anything. I even just started a Substack now, and it's totally for free. Although people still gave me money, so now I feel like I have to do something special for those people. Because you know what? I want to make sure it is all worthwhile. But really, you can follow me anywhere at all. And I apologize ahead of time if I'm going to be banging the drum about this book. But I actually really love it, and I'm excited to share it with people.
Great. The book is Joyful Recollections of Trauma. It's available for pre-order now. It ships on May 21st.
Yes.
Get the pre-order in, and now you guys know you're going to have a postcard to use as a bookmark.
Yes, you are. You're going to get it. It's going to be great. It's going to be signed. It's all real.
Nice. You can follow Finding Favorites on Instagram, Finding Faves Pod. You can send me an email, findingfavoritespodcast@gmail.com. Rate and review on Apple Podcasts, Good Pods, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And keep enjoying your favorite things.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.